What Bible did the Apostle Paul grow up reading? Or Jesus, for that matter, any of the other apostles? Well, this complex question demonstrates the need for understanding the Septuagint, which is a fancy name for a stream of translations of the Hebrew Bible into Greek, the language of the New Testament. Dr. Greg Lanier joins us to discuss what the Septuagint is and why it matters today. We're going to talk about common misconceptions about the Septuagint, as well as issues of textual transmission and reliability and all those types of things that get really technical, but I think are really, really helpful. We also talk about debates regarding the Apocrypha or the deuterocanonical books that are accepted by Roman Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox, but rejected by Protestants. Why is that the case? What can we learn from those debates? What are the reasons behind fathers like Jerome rejecting the Apocrypha? And how does that factor into these conversations? So get ready for a deep dive into history and theology. Enjoy this episode. You're listening to That'll Preach. Excited to have our guest on today. We have Dr. Greg Lanier. He serves Associate Professor of New Testament at RTS Orlando, Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando, Florida. He's also an Associate Pastor at River Oaks Church, which is a PCA church. He's written a bunch of books, Old Made New, A Guide to the New Testament, Use of the Old Testament, The Septuagint, What It Is and Why It Matters, and also Is Jesus Truly God? How the Bible Teaches the divinity of Christ. So it's quite the list of books, man. I mean, how do you crank all these out? You wrote these all in the past year, which is amazing.
No, they were all. There's different things I've done. So yeah, it's been a privilege. So,
yeah. Well, we got you here live, and we're in person for our theology conference, which was really cool.
I know, and you're getting extra money worth.
I know. We're just squeezing everything we can out of this. But I had some great sessions talking about Old Testament canon, which is a fascinating topic. And you talked about how do we understand the Old Testament in light of the New, which is great. Mm-hmm. And but one of the books that I remember reading back in the day and that I think has been a fascinating topic is the Septuagint. And you've written a book about that. We'll have a link in the show notes if you want to get that. Yep. But
with my partner in crime, Will Ross.
Will Ross. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Will Ross out there. But this is something that, I didn't really know much about until I went to seminary. Mm-hmm. And I started hearing about this mysterious thing, this right. mysterious Greek translation of the Old Testament. And it wasn't something that I knew just in the common evangelical world. People didn't really talk about it. So right. I'm kind of curious, now that you've written a book on it, you spent a lot of time studying the Septuagint, what got you into this area of study?
Right, yeah. And probably, one of the things that Will and I have been trying to do is increase knowledge among sort of ordinary people, because it has typically been a very scholarly, nerdy thing. You see the Septuagint mentioned in the footnotes of most English Bibles, and so it is a thing that you'll bump into, but not super well known. I probably didn't know much about it, actually, whenever I was in seminary. So trying to change that, actually, in my own teaching, I know Will is as well. I mean, I probably had heard of it, but I wouldn't have really known like where to find it per se and what exactly to do with it. So I actually kind of got more interested in it late in seminary as I was writing some papers, mostly in preparation for further study. And so my doctoral work in particular got me more into the field of Septuagint study. So I came in really from the New Testament door, and then I actually met Will overseas. And he's an actual proper, Septuagint scholar from the Old Testament side. And so we started kicking ideas around. Actually, the first thing we did together was a reader's edition of the Septuagint. So that was our first big project. And then a vocabulary intro. And then we wrote the Crossway book. So it was mostly through New Testament stuff, particularly Luke's gospel, but just in general, kind of the use of the old and the new was kind of my gateway into the world of the Septuagint. So,
well, I remember from your classes when you teach on Romans or Acts. I mean, you would sort of have the what the New Testament says, and you compare it to the Septuagint, and
that was
kind of like, wait a minute, it's kind of this. It's not going directly back to Hebrew. There's this sort of middle,
right? Document. At least in many cases, yeah.
Yeah, so, in many cases, and that was fascinating to mm-hmm. me. Now, maybe we're throwing out Septuagint. People are like, what is that thing?
Is this some
kind of weird creature? Right. Yeah, or something like that. But what is that? If you want to just give a layman's description of what the Septuagint is, what would you say?
Yeah, that's kind of the most important starting point. There's a few different ways you can define it, but the sort of the easiest is to think of it as a stream of translational activity. Because there's no, like, if you go back to the ancient world, there's no like Amazon that has a Septuagint to buy like you can today. And if you're going to buy one, buy the Reader's Edition from Gregory R. Lanier and, William A. Ross. But that really didn't exist. But what you do have is various groups of people translating the Hebrew of the Old Testament into what had become their vernacular of the day, starting roughly in 200 BC with the first five books. And then it was a long process to kind of finish it all out. So it's essentially a translation of the Hebrew text into what had become the lingua franca of the day, namely Greek. And so it's similar in spirit to the fact that we have English Bibles or Spanish Bibles today, all of which go back to either the Hebrew Old Testament or the Greek New Testament. This is a translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into the language that the world was speaking in its day, because most had moved on from Hebrew, because it was under Alexander the Great and his successors, the world kind of converted to Greek. So
you're saying this, it's not like one translation.
It started out that way. That's where it gets nuanced. Okay. So strictly speaking, you can use the term Septuagint for the original Greek Pentateuch, because that was what was translated first.
First five books.
And that probably was a small team effort in a relatively small amount of time,
right?
Most likely. So if you want to say something is the Septuagint, you would call that the Septuagint. But Septuagint became a label for really what is kind of a family of translational activities, really, that took a long time and a lot of different people, some in Egypt, maybe others elsewhere, working their way through the different books. And in fact, editing books in different, like once you have a translation of one of the books, it didn't just sort of stay put. Sometimes they say, oh, they would correct it and start saying, well, you know, I need to make it better. And so you even have editing activity over time too. So it just makes it all complex. So for us, we would say, okay, it's basically like a river. It's a coherent river,
sure,
but it has tributaries and different spinoffs, and it's lots of people over a long period of time fundamentally taking the Hebrew Bible and putting it into Greek. And then even editing that and changing that. There's two versions of Daniel and blah, blah, blah. There's some complexity, but that's essentially what we're talking about. It's no different than you could sort of say, there's the English translation river, right?
Sure.
That started with like Tyndale and so forth, and has different tributaries, but there is kind of, okay, here's a bunch of different English translations that are all in English Bible from the Hebrew and Greek. And so Septuagint is kind of like that, just in Greek.
What motivated these Jews to start translating? I mean, I guess I don't understand. I understand why, I guess. You're saying Alexander the Great kind of Hellenizes the world, and so there's a need for a translation. Is that kind of what's motivating that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit shrouded in mystery, but there's probably two motivations, and both kind of operating at
book
the same
sales,
time.
Book sales, number one.
Book sales.
Yeah.
No, the one would be you have the Jewish community spread around the world post-exile and post-restoration, so where the Old Testament ends off. And initially, they are all under the Persians, and so the Persian Empire spoke Aramaic. And then when Alexander the Great conquers the known world in relatively short fashion, and everyone sort of for trade and so forth has to start using Greek, you have a Jewish community spread around the world that, if they want to be involved in society and be involved in commerce and trade and politics, they've got to at least have some capability in Greek. So fast forward then, you have the first generation, right? They've got to start speaking Greek. And then this is a little bit of an oversimplification. And then their kids. So the first generation is like, we still have Hebrew in the synagogue, and then we speak Greek. The next generation, what happens to their kids? They don't know as much Hebrew, but they're pretty decent in Greek.
Right.
And then their kids, and this happens today, right? Their kids don't do any Hebrew anymore at all.
They just only know the Greek.
Like, they go home and they visit their grandparents, and it's like, I don't know what you're saying, but I only do Greek. And so there was a need in the Jewish community in the aftermath of all of that. It's like, we need a Bible in our language now. It's actually, I think it's quite beautiful that they never felt like, hey, the only way to know God, to know Yahweh, is in Hebrew. Like, yes, Hebrew is the most, like, Hebrew is where inspiration happened, but we can't really read that. So what do? We need to translate it to a language that we can use in the synagogue and be able to read Moses in the language that we know. So I think worship was probably the primary motivator, where they actually needed a Bible, which is no different. I mean, that's very Reformation, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because the if you think about it from a biblical perspective, the Jewish community, because of Abraham, right? Because of Adam, Noah, et cetera, there's a lot of biblical theology. They were wired to, at least on their better days, to reach the world, right? That was what the whole point of the Abrahamic covenant was. And so part of that is linguistic. You can't reach the world if you're like, everyone has to speak Hebrew, right? It's not going to work. So there's actually something, I think, really remarkable about that in the providence of God. And then probably the second motivation was under the Greeks, you know, generally speaking, they wanted to have access to every conquered people's group, people group's sort of legal code. And so as the Jews were conquered by the successors of Alexander the Great, they were like, hey, we need your law code. We need the Torah in a language that we can read. And so that might have been another motivation was, okay, we need to provide our book of laws in the language that our overlords could read. So that might have been another motivation under the Ptolemies.
So they were like practical and then political reasons why they did this, but they still recognized the Hebrew scriptures as that's strictly speaking what's inspired.
Mm-hmm. That's why they translated it.
Right.
In other words,
they
like
viewed
a good translation. So what's interesting is that when you look at whenever they would revise it, and they say, okay, we have Daniel in Greek, but you know what? It's not a very good translation. We need to make it better. And what we're going to do is we're going to make it closer to the Hebrew, because Hebrew is always understood to be the standard. And what we're trying to do, it's a very common misconception. When they translate it into Greek, they're not thinking this is the inspired new version and we don't care about the Hebrew anymore. It's not actually the motivation, nor was that actually what's happening in the early church when they embrace the Septuagint. They have the translation to give access to the Hebrew, which is exactly what we do today. What makes a good English translation today is it's readable, but it's also faithful to the Hebrew, not because we want to idolize the English, but because we want access to what the Hebrew says. And it, by and large, the motivation is true for them as well. So the standard was always the Hebrew, and like getting close to that was the goal. So there's never a real sense that they're like, hey, we're going to replace the Hebrew with this other thing and make that our inspired source. Like, no. It's a window to what we still think is the inspired source. We just don't have the ability to read. Like, most of us aren't very good at reading the Hebrew anymore, other than the scribes and the priest or whatever. So that was more what they were getting at. And the church fathers were the same way. You know, when the church fathers talk about the Septuagint, they don't talk about it as if, hey, this is the thing that has replaced the Hebrew Bible. They, by and large, they say this gives us access to the Hebrew Bible that, with very few exceptions, most of the church fathers couldn't read Hebrew, Jerome being a major exception. So they needed some way to get at it. And so they're like, okay, the Septuagint is our gateway to what we think is the inspired word, but we just don't use it the way we should.
So using that translation analogy with the English translation, is it, could there be a parallel be drawn where you lift up your ESV, and you're like,
or NIV, or other
NIV, or NIV,
qualified Bible translation.
The ESV.
This episode,
right?
Brought to you by Crossway. By
yeah, exactly. Right. So you look at that, and you could see you're preaching from it. You would say, well, "This is the Word of God." Mm-hmm. But strictly speaking, you'd be like, "Well, this is a translation of the original." Like you would, you would say that really this is a translation, I guess, that accesses the original manuscripts or the original manuscripts are there. But they're translated so we can have access to them.
Right.
There would still be some kind of a distance. And I suppose I could see why someone might say the Septuagint is inspired in the sense of they're viewing it as a faithful transmission of what is inspired. Or do they have more of a delineation between that?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you're talking about. But I think applying the category of inspired to the Septuagint is not really historically well grounded, although some did sort of apply that language, and there was a big debate among Origen, Jerome, and Augustine on that front. But at least what we try to do in the book at the end is it's interesting to use the term Word of God. So we say, okay, the normative place that we want to call Scripture, that is what has been breathed out by God and given to his people, and just limiting ourselves to the Hebrew side of it, that is found in the Hebrew text as best we can reconstruct it today, right? And by and large, with a few exceptions, that is where the locus of authority is found for doctrine, which is why you learn languages in seminary, whatever. And so that's pretty consistent throughout church history as well. And then we use the term word of God for that middle ground, which is a faithful translation of the upstream original is for God's people, the word of God. Hmm. And it's not a perfect taxonomy.
Yeah.
We've taken some criticism for it, but our goal was to try to say any authority of that is simply derived from
sure.
its upstream source to the extent that it accurately reflects that upstream source. So again, the way you would judge. So if you're in a church in, pick a country, a non-English speaking country, just as an example, and you're preaching to some Swahili speaking people, as an example, you're not going to read the Hebrew typically, right? You're going to stand up and read a Swahili Bible.
Sure.
And what are you going to say? This is the word of the Lord.
Right.
Because you're persuaded that it is a faithful translation, not perfect, but a faithful translation that gives access to the place that we think scripture or the word of God actually is found. And so we hope that that was kind of a helpful analogy that like there's really no functional difference between the Septuagint as a Greek translation from a long time ago and a Mandarin or a French or a Spanish or an English translation that is either more or less good, but is still trying to give access to the original text that we do think is the ultimate source. So to the, you know, some folks want to say, well, okay, if the New Testament authors use the Septuagint then and quote from it, then does that somehow confer upon it inspired status? And where we land is no, it does not. Like just because Paul quotes from the Septuagint and takes a verse from Leviticus and quotes it in the Greek form, that doesn't like magically infuse all of Greek Leviticus with this magical superpower of inspiration. That doesn't really make any sense any more so than doing that in English would. We convey some magic power. It's simply he's using the text that his audience had, right? Just like I do on tomorrow morning, I'm going to preach from the ESV. I'm preaching from the Greek, actually, fundamentally, but I'm using a pew Bible that the people I'm preaching to use, and so that's what I'm going to quote from. It would be weird for me not to do that. So I think that's a better way. It's like they're using the text form that their audience is familiar with that conveys the meaning that is sufficient for the point they're trying to make.
You're going to preach from the Greek. That's pretty awesome.
No, I'm developing. Yeah, no, I mean, okay. As a nerd, I derive my sermon from the Hebrew and the Greek. And then if you tell me that you're an NIV church, fine, that's what I'll read before I preach. But my sermon is developed from the original text. But anyway, that's a different point.
It's funny. I saw on Instagram, it was like this KJV only guy where he's like, you know, when I say KJV only, I mean, I think the KJV can correct the Greek. I was like, wow.
Well,
that's some pretty intense stuff.
And to be fair, the King James is a fantastic translation.
Right for?
In terms of translation philosophy. Quite a miracle for its time, but
inspired perhaps?
Not inspired. Nah,
almost had you. Almost
I would say you. I think they would say that you'd be crazy to think that they were inspired in their task. They were just trying to be faithful.
There you go. There you go. Well, you mentioned how, okay, the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament is quoted a lot of places in the New Testament. So how does getting a grasp of the Septuagint help us interpret the New Testament? Why is that important for us to understand this Greek text?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of four categories. When you look at quotations and such of the Old Testament and the New, there's kind of four categories. One is it's very clear that the apostolic author is drawing on something that, so far as we can tell, because again, we don't have the handwritten copy of something from Moses. We're having to reconstruct it from the evidence that we do have. But so far as we can tell, they are drawing on something that is closer to what we know as the Hebrew and is different from what we find in the quote-unquote Septuagint. So a good example of that is, actually was going over that this morning when the Matthew 2 quotation of out of Egypt I called my son, even though Matthew's writing in Greek, and he's quoting Hosea 11, the wording that he is using is clearly from the Hebrew because the Hebrew says exactly that, just in Hebrew, out of Egypt I called my son. And the Greek that we know, as far back as we can reconstruct it for Hosea 11, says out of Egypt I called my children, which is not the same thing, it's plural. And so he can't be using that argument wouldn't have worked for him. So he can't be using the
Septuagint.
He's got to be using, he's got to be using some form that is the closest to the Masoretic. So that's one category where it's like they seem to be using something that's closer to the Hebrew. Then maybe there's three categories. Then there's a middle category, which is the Greek and the Hebrew are functionally indistinguishable.
Okay.
So you wouldn't know either way. So a lot of times, like when they quote Leviticus 19:18, the Hebrew says one thing, the Greek says verbatim what the Hebrew says. It's not hard. There's no mystery here. It's a very faithful word-for-word rendering of love your neighbor as yourself. And then when the New Testament authors quote that verse multiple times, they're all identical. And you don't really care whether they're getting it. You don't know if they're getting it from the Hebrew or the Greek, because the Greek and the Hebrew are functionally the same, just in different languages. So that's probably the majority, actually, where the Greek, as we know it in the quote-unquote Septuagint, is so close to what we know in the Hebrew that they're basically the same and it's fine, right? Close enough. So yeah, maybe they're using the Septuagint, but there's no real difference. And then the more interesting category is Paul or whomever is quoting something from Isaiah or what have you, and it's really close to the Septuagint, or identical to Septuagint, and it differs from what we have in the Hebrew in some meaningful ways. And there's, depending on how, where you want to draw the line, there's a pretty good number of those where it's like, okay, it seems pretty likely that they're making their point based on some wording that is found in the Greek. And when you compare it to my Hebrew Bible that I got for seminary, it's not the same, because the Greek translator, for whatever reason, there's two reasons why this would happen. Either they interpreted it in a different way and sort of in their translation, they became more sort of New Living Translation and more loose, if you will, as opposed to being kind of NASB style and being word for word. Or the Hebrew they were translating might not have been identical to what we have today. Does that make sense?
Gotcha.
Because the Hebrew that we have, and you see this in your Old Testament, right? When you read the Old Testament, 99% of the time, like, yeah, it's pretty secure here. But there's the 1% of the time where it's like, actually, here's one Hebrew version. Here's what we have from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Here's what we have from whatever. And so we're not 100% sure. So even the ESV will have those kinds of footnotes in Deuteronomy 32 and that kind of stuff. So they could just be translating from a different Hebrew. Does that mean it's the better Hebrew? We don't know. It just means that the scribes weren't perfect in terms of how they copied it. So there could be different reasons. So that category of they're making an argument based on the Septuagint only is really relevant when it's differing from what we know from the Hebrew. And so that one's the interesting category.
Debated. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about that. Like, what do we make of those differences? You said it could have been that the textual tradition of the Hebrew text could have variants, I guess, and that they're translating those, so you'd expect variations. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're kind of interpreting it, trying to show, you know, lean the reader toward a particular understanding of the Hebrew via their translation, something like that. When Paul is quoting Septuagint, or I don't know, one of the New Testament authors, are they aware of what the Hebrew says and they're choosing to use the other one? Or like, how are they, you know, are they going, this translation kind of gets more of what I'm saying? Or does that make sense? Like, what was,
right? I
mean, what did they think they were doing?
Right. I mean, those are all, you know, the natural questions. That the challenge is, it's almost impossible to answer those questions. And here's why. Well, we can't like inquire what's happening in Paul's mind, right? If we have him in the third chair here, we could ask him. So we're trying to piece it together based on evidence that we have. And the reason why that's such a vexed discussion is because you have Paul quoting it a certain way. And it could be a conscious decision to adopt a certain wording that he thinks fits his arguments better than what we now know as the Masoretic. And then you'd have to deal with those kind of implications. Or it could just be the wording that he was familiar with that just happens to not be what later gets put in the Masoretic in the first millennium text that we use for our English Bibles. And you don't know.
Would they have been aware of the Hebrew text? Like, would they?
Well, what I'm saying is it's almost, to call it the Hebrew text is actually not even terribly accurate, because yes, there is a stable textual tradition, sure.
Yeah.
But it's not perfect. And we know that from a lot of evidence. In fact, you know, your English Bibles mention all that stuff. The Syriac says this, or the Targum say this, or whatever. Samaritan Pentateuch. You see these things in your footnotes.
Yeah.
So no one's trying to hide anything. But to say, was Paul aware of what the Hebrews said is kind of a funny way to phrase it, because there's a limited amount of diversity in what the Hebrew even was. And again, you can demonstrably prove that from the manuscripts that we have. So he would probably just kind of be puzzled at the question, like, what do you mean? Hmm. By saying the Hebrew, because in the synagogue that he's working from, it says this. And that may not be the same thing that later becomes known as the Masoretic text in 1000 AD, which has an earlier history. So it's kind of a funny thing to ask. Like, you just don't know.
I guess I'm wondering if the Bible he grew up with was the Septuagint. Does that make sense? Like, if that was...
I think the Bible he grew up with is similar to what we have today in a certain sense, where, you know, I grew up with the NIV 84. So my memorization of certain verses is NIV 84.
Okay.
And then I read it in the ESV and I'm like, huh, it's different than what I grew up with.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I read it in NIV 11 or CSB or whatever. And in other words, we all exist, unless you're in, you know, a KJV only circle, we all exist in a plurality of texts that are all basically saying the same thing, but with some variation. Even having kids like, oh, why does it say it this way here? It's like, well, it's complicated. Having to explain those kinds of things. And so my sense is, as Paul is traveling around, as a Pharisee, certainly he would have known Hebrew and would have interacted with the Bible in Hebrew. That doesn't mean it was always everywhere the same Hebrew. You could have local variations
in
Jerusalem,
okay. Yeah.
Where
yeah.
it got copied slightly differently here. And if he's on the road, he doesn't have a whole Torah cabinet with him.
Right,
it's huge. And so when he gets to Corinth and he's going to write some stuff, he's got to go to the local synagogue. It's like, oh, it's slightly different there. And maybe it's Hebrew, maybe it's Greek. Don't know. It could be both. And so so maybe the takeaway is it's actually just way more complicated than I think folks realize, which folks don't like complexity. I get that. I don't like it either. I mean, I think it's fun. It helps pay the bills for me, but, like to ask these kinds of questions, I hate to not give solid answers, but it's actually really hard to pin down because you're like, take Matthew as another example. Matthew was bilingual. He was Levi in his Jewish side of his life. He's had two names, because as many did, he was Matthew for his day job as a Roman tax collector, right? So his day job, he's speaking Greek, and then, you know, back home he's speaking Hebrew. And so, and he's an educated man. And in Matthew, when you read his quotations, sometimes they seem to be closer to what we now know as the Hebrew. Sometimes they seem to be a little bit closer to quote unquote the Septuagint. Sometimes they're kind of in between. When he quotes Isaiah 42 and Matthew 12. And so you're kind of scratching your heads like, well, which Bible is he using? And you're like, well, like all of them, because he's multilingual and an apostle who's traveling around and using what he had. Maybe he's memorized some of it. Sometimes he's quoting from memory. Sometimes maybe he's looking at a written, printed text, but it might not be exactly the same in Capernaum as it is in Jerusalem, whatever. So it's all just complicated. When you have memorization, local variant copies, the linguistic stuff with Hebrew and Greek here and there. As a side note that hopefully will be better answers to this. So Will and I are editing a volume with systematic theologians, historical theologians, and so on, Reformation people and so on, that is trying to answer some of these questions in a more helpful way. We tried to in the Crossway book, but only got part of the way there. And so it's going to be called The Authority of the Septuagint, a sort of multidisciplinary perspective. And so we have people much smarter than us, John Fesco and others, who are saying, okay, how do we grapple when we believe in certain doctrine of scripture and a certain doctrine of the preservation of the Hebrew and the Greek?
Yeah.
How do we grapple with some of these questions of, well, what if, you know, here's another example. What if Paul cites this verse from the Old Testament, and the wording he uses is different than what Matthew does and is different than what James does, which actually happens for passages where they are all going back to the same text, like Deuteronomy 6, 4 and 5, or Isaiah 6 is another example. It's quoted in all four Gospels plus Acts, and every single quotation of Isaiah 6, 9 through 10 is different in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. And so what do you do with that? How do we think about that in light of these considerations? And one of the people contributing is like, it kind of just seems like the New Testament authors didn't care about the question. that they're just using whatever text they had available.
Yeah.
They didn't sort of pour all of this angst about things. They're like, okay, I'm writing to this audience. I'm in Antioch. Lo and behold, I looked up the copy of Isaiah 6 in Antioch, and this is what it said. And then maybe I tweaked a little bit. I dropped a word. I summarized it because we do that when we preach. It's almost like they didn't seem stressed about it because they're like, they're just using God's word to preach. You know, they just didn't feel as like uptight about it. Maybe. And so anyway, we'll see where it goes.
Well, maybe we wouldn't if we lived in those days.
Right.
You know,
because I mean, quotation standards are so different. I mean, there is no app with the Bible on it in that day. I mean, the printing press era, the digital era makes everything so different where we think, like when the ESV, not to throw stones at them, when they said we're now doing the permanent edition in 2016 of the ESV and everyone pitched a fit, like, what are you talking about? Like, this is it forever for the next 500 years or never changing it? And they backed off of that because, like, look, English changes, we update stuff. We find new manuscripts that maybe correct our reading. So like there's a new edition of Revelation coming out by the Brainiacs in Germany, and it'll impact the future editions of the Greek New Testament. And it has 100 changes in it. I don't know what they are yet. Haven't bought it yet. But so it's like, all right, what are you going to do with that? Because now we think based on our evidence that we've gathered over the past 50 years, that actually we need to tweak it here and there. And this is a better version of Revelation. So that kind of stuff keeps happening.
Have you read the Gen Z Bible?
Is that the one with like emojis and stuff, or
it's got all kinds of Gen Z. You would love it.
Oh, nice.
You would love it.
So point being, it just was a profoundly different world. And so maybe part of the Septuagint stuff is sort of getting back to like, hey, let's be historically grounded and hey, we don't have to panic, but also let's know really what's happening back then. And I find it to be really interesting and engaging, but.
So what do we do when, I mean, is there an example in the New Testament that's notable where there's a quotation from the Septuagint that the wording is clearly very different from.
Oh, sure. There's several. Yeah.
From the Hebrew. And when you come across that, you know, how do we think through that?
Yeah. So you know, a good example, I had my computer in front of me. I could do a better job with this, but in Romans 15, Paul quotes a bunch of Old Testament passages, kind of as the clinches argument. And mostly from Isaiah or Deuteronomy or what have you. And he's trying to like seal the deal on his argument that the salvific fate of Jews and Gentiles has been intertwined in the purposes of God. And he's been riffing on that as a way to bring unity to the church at Rome and the competing factions of Jews and Gentiles. And so that's why he's done Abraham and he's Romans 9 through 11 and all those kinds of things. So in Romans 15, he's dancing around different places. And one of the quotations from Isaiah, very clearly, the wording is only from the Greek there. And it's essentially, it's the crescendo of a comment that, actually this was from Deuteronomy, it's Deuteronomy 32, not Isaiah, where in Moses' farewell song, one of these verses concludes with, and the nations will hope in his name. And for Paul, it's like, exactly. And the hymn.
That's what he's getting at. Yeah.
Whereas the Hebrew, and again, if I had my computer in front of me, I could quote it better, but sort of going off memory, is I think something like the coastlands await his law or something along those lines. So don't quote me on that. But it's like, yeah, that's obviously not the same.
Yeah.
But you can make a pretty good argument that the translator of Isaiah, of Deuteronomy or Isaiah, I'm confusing my categories here, but it's been a long day. They're doing a faithful paraphrastic translation. And Paul's like, great, I'm just going to use that. Or maybe he wasn't even aware, right? He could have just been like, this is just the version that I've memorized growing up. Or it could be a different Hebrew version that we don't have. So for me, I don't worry too much about it because Paul did what he did. And either he's adopting something that does better fit his argument because maybe he thought it was a better translation, or version he uses is the same as the Hebrew he was aware of and just isn't the same as the Hebrew that we have today. Or something like that. So I don't lose.
But
a lot
is the
of sleep
meaning
over.
Different? Like, if the is the meaning contained within the Hebrew that maybe the translation is a gloss of it, or
yeah,
or
I mean I think that's often the case.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are there cases where the Septuagint has a verse that it translated to where the actual meaning is changed? It's that's not what the Hebrew author is trying to say.
I guess one question would be like, who decides that? And I'm not trying to be like super postmodernist, but what am I trying to say here? I don't think there are any major situations where there's a massive difference. And the reason why I'm sort of hesitating here is the thing that you can never really answer, and this is something that once you get in the weeds of Septuagint scholarship becomes so clear, is you don't always know what the Septuagint translator is even translating from. Does that make sense? So whenever you read books on the Septuagint, they're like, oh, this is different. Like, but it could be different because either they were doing some sort of weird interpretation that doesn't fit with the meaning of the original, or they just had a different Hebrew, right? And they're doing a perfectly fine translation from a Hebrew that we no longer have. And it's just really hard to ever prove or disprove either one of those options. And so,
but that would mean that there was another Hebrew that you'd have two Hebrew variants that contradict each other.
It depends. Yeah. Contradiction is probably not the term I would use. But yes, you definitely have Hebrew variations in the history. Yeah. The historical tradition. So one example would be, the ordering of the Ten Commandments. So the, 6th, 7th, and 8th commandments in the Masoretic text are don't commit murder, kill, don't commit adultery, don't steal. Murder, adultery, theft. And so that in Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5, that's the order. Same order shows up in other Semitic languages. But the oldest copy of Deuteronomy that we have is something known as the Nash Papyrus. It doesn't go in that order. Hmm. And then if you look at the quote-unquote Septuagint of Exodus 20, it's also not that order. If you look at Deuteronomy in the quote-unquote Septuagint, it's yet another different order. Adultery, murder, stealing, or stealing, adultery, murder, or whatever. There's all these permutations. And when you look at the New Testament, Matthew goes one way, Luke goes another way, Paul goes a different way, James goes a different way. They don't all agree on the same order of those three subgroup of commandments. And so you're like, all right, well, what do you do with that? I don't know what you do with that. And that's just the data. It appears, based on the Nash Papyrus, that there was a different Hebrew ordering that isn't the same thing as a Masoretic.
Right.
Now, does it make a big difference? Not really, but it is true. I mean, we just know that we have those kinds of things. And I don't think our doctrine of scripture is like jettison on the rocks because of that. Our doctrine of scripture says that inspiration happens in the original autographs, which we don't actually have, thankfully, because we would turn them into some sort of amusement park and idolatrous thing, right?
Yeah.
If they turned the bronze serpent into an idol,
yeah,
Nahushtan, imagine what they would do if we actually had, you know, the writings of Moses. So, but that the fact that God has in his wise providence prevented us from having the actual, this is what Moses wrote, I think is actually a kindness. But the downside is the copying process was not perfect across the board, right? I mean, never is. And so you do have different Hebrew copies, and you just deal with the data. So I mean, the reality is, if you look at your English Bible, ESV included, many, many times they don't accept the Masoretic reading, even though on the whole they do. But there are plenty of times where they say the Masoretic says this, but we're going with this alternative because we think that actually is probably authentic and that the Masoretic is wrong. And all the English Bibles do that. Does that make sense?
So you're saying that when they choose the Septuagint over the Masoretic, it's because they think that that's tracing to a more accurate tradition that maybe we don't have.
Yeah, but we might not have it in Hebrew, but it in Greek, and the Greek comes from the Hebrew, and it's different, and therefore it might be better. We just don't. And that's where the nerds kind of get together and try to sort it all out. It's a very complicated argument, and you have to handle it case by case. So again, to be clear, on the whole, the Masoretic text, I think, best encapsulates our best approximation of what we think God inspired Moses and Ezra and everyone to write, David. But even the Masoretes didn't think it was perfect, right? That's why they're making footnotes and comments and margins and saying, actually, it says this, but it should mean this. And they do the vowels differently, whatever. So when you take Hebrew, you learn all these kinds of things. So even the Masoretes weren't under the impression that they had perfectly preserved it, right? Because they were fallible. And so we just roll up our sleeves and do the hard work of saying, all right, here's the evidence. What do we think best we can tell the original text would have said? And that's a process that we go through. So, point being, there could be competing options and you sort it out. I don't think that's like, you know, that's a fraction of them, but they're important.
I think some of these things are more scary when they're unexamined than when you actually get in, you're like, oh, you know what? It's more complicated than I thought, but the mere presence of complication doesn't mean, you know, that you have to throw out your doctrine of inspiration or anything like that. And the fact that even people,
you just got to have a better doctrine of inspiration. Yeah. Actually, fundamentally, that's what it's about. So, I mean, if you ask Will or ask me, you know, working on the Septuagint, has that caused you like doubt things? Like, no, actually it's called it. Even though sometimes it seems scary, right? And you ask these questions, and I ask those questions too, the more you do the research, the more you realize, okay, A, it is way more complicated than I probably realized, but there are good answers, or at least we're trying to come up with a way to wrestle with the data honestly and also, you know, confessionally and faithfully. And I'm happy that there are, you know, people out there that are doing the work. To try to say, look, the bad option is to look at some of the messy, complicated data and just say, Bible is fallible. That's an option that many people take. But I think there's a much better option, which is it's complicated and we don't always have all the answers, but here's the direction to kind of approximate the answer and affirm what we're persuaded needs to be affirmed about the nature of God's word. So,
well, you said something, last night about how, you know, we don't want to have a brittle understanding of the inspiration of Scripture, and also that, you know, you can still, for the layperson, you can trust, you know, the Bible. We don't have to be, I guess, panicky about these kinds of things, but it's important to look into them,
right?
You know, and I remember you saying too, it's actually remarkable how much is preserved, like how much agreement there is, like you were talking about the New Testament canon among all the traditions, that the fact that there is an agreement is remarkable. Or the fact that we do actually have a Masoretic text is remarkable.
Right.
The Dead Sea Scrolls or stuff like that. Sometimes we can only look at the complicated stuff and not realize how much we take for granted that's there.
Yeah. And even, and, you know, so if you think of other literature, my esteemed colleague in Orlando was talking about this recently in a faculty meeting that you take something like the Epic of Gilgamesh, very famous, read in high school. And he said, actually, one of the things that's kind of interesting in sort of Akkadian cuneiform studies is that, like, there's not really the Epic of Gilgamesh. What you have is a plural tradition of, okay, well, there's this version and there's that version, and there's that version. And that, I mean, the same thing is true, like, of the Iliad. And, I mean, even Shakespeare kind of has lots of complexities. And so, I mean, it's not surprising that we would see complexity in the data. Same thing is true with anything. Because again, they don't have computers. They don't have Google Drive. And so even though God is superintending the process to preserve his word, there's, you know, scribes and copyists just weren't perfect all the time. And so so you can either ignore that, or sort of chalk it up to like conspiracy theory, blah, blah, blah. You can either run with it and say, okay, we can't trust the Bible at all. Or you can say, all right, fair enough. So let's go and do the hard work to sort all this out. And I think that's a much more healthy, actually, place to be. And
well, I mean, if it's like a historical document, if it's passed through transmission through time, if it's a pre-modern, you know,
era,
it's like, what do you expect?
Right.
Kind of thing. You know, it actually makes it feel more real and historical that, like, these are ancient, these are really ancient texts. People really did read them, write them, you know, like, and some on a flip, it actually makes it feel more just real.
Right.
In a sense.
And I think you can do that and still affirm that the original Hebrew and original Greek.
Right.
Were directly, verbally, organically inspired by God.
Right.
We don't have to go and say it was all just a mess in the process.
Right.
And so what our goal is to say, all right, we believe that is a proposition that actually, when we were talking about this morning, that's actually what Scripture attests about itself,
right?
That it is Spirit given in the words. And you're like, but we don't have that. And so what do? We got all of this. And from all of this, what we're trying to do, and bright minds working on it for a long time, is say, all right, well, how do we work backwards to get to that?
Right.
And
right.
I would say, you know, we're 99.9% of the way there. And then you throw in the Septuagint, and that makes it, the Septuagint for me is actually one of the things where it's really useful is that, yes, there's the New Testament use of it, and that's all important and interesting. But it's actually really interesting when it comes to helping us reconstruct the Hebrew, because it's, you know, the copies that we have of the right. Septuagint are centuries earlier than what is translated in your ESV NIV, which is the Masoretic text. And so most of the time it confirms. So like if you think Masoretic text is 1000 AD, ballpark, you know, the Greek translation of Deuteronomy or whatever goes back to 200 BC, right? 1200 years. That's a long time. And the striking thing is, and as Will and I do all this work and we're comparing these editions and so on and various projects we're working on together, it's actually pretty stunning how often they are exactly the same.
Yeah.
Even though one is in Greek, it's like, that's exactly what that should be based on the Hebrew. And you're like, man, that means that it was very stable, like mind-bogglingly stable for over a millennium, which is, yeah. Like when you just think statistically speaking, God's got to be at work in that.
Right, right.
But in other words, when you have the wording that we use, and in most cases, you go way, way, way back to, say, the Septuagint, and you see a separate, you know, see wording, you're like, yep, those all line up and those match over a millennium plus time frame. And so then you're left with like a handful that don't. And you're like, all right, let's just work on that. Why is that? And so for me, it's like, I'm actually like kind of surprised there's not more.
Yeah.
The fact that there aren't shows you, okay, God's at work here and providence is real. Now, does that mean that everyone in this process all agreed all the time? No, but of course they wouldn't. I mean, right. When have we ever done that?
And you can kind of sensationalize the exceptions, you know, like
that's the risk. Yeah. Right, I mean, the risk is if you want to be maximally skeptical and critical, then you would take the exceptions and say, see, we told you can't trust the Bible. I'm like, yeah, but you're ignoring all of this.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, take the Dead Sea Scrolls, another example, which is kind of adjacent to the Septuagint. A lot of work on the Dead Sea Scrolls in recent years has, especially with new ones that we've been able to crack the code, some of the ones that were like burned and we were able to digitally unroll them, some copies of Leviticus and so forth. Some of the oldest things we have. And they're like, all right, this is from 300 BC and it's this charred fragment of Leviticus. And we use CT machines and all kinds of stuff to decipher it. And they're like, wow. I think one of them, it was 100% match
really
with the Masoretic from 1300 years later.
Yeah.
Like that's astounding that like the scribes were that good.
Right.
Were they always that good? No, but who is?
And I guess you could see.
I mess up things all the time and I have Word, you know?
Right. And you make a lot of charts too.
I make a lot of charts and mess those up.
A lot of chance to make mistakes, but I guess you could even project backwards. If from the Dead Sea Scrolls to the Masoretic text, there's a strong transmission.
Mm-hmm. And the Septuagint would be same kind of evidence.
You could also go backwards. I mean, like, why would they? I think you could reasonably say there's probably a strong transmission from before the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Well, that's the step that we all have to grapple with, right? So you get to a certain point where you don't have any older copies.
Right.
And same thing is true for the New Testament.
Yeah.
And so there is an inductive step that we need to be honest about. We're saying, okay, the oldest copy of whatever it is dated here, but we know it was written 900 years prior to that or whatever. And we don't have copies from then.
Right.
And so we just have to be honest that it's like, okay, that's why we say we're doing our best to faithfully reconstruct from the evidence that we have what we think God inspired, because we don't have that. And same thing is true in the New Testament. It's not quite as big a window of time. And I think based on the downstream evidence that you're talking about, you know, where these things match up over a millennium, I think we have good reason to work our way upstream. But we have to be honest that we are making an inductive step. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the New Testament earliest manuscripts we have are 150 to 225, and they're just little fragments. And then you start to get fuller copies much later. And so with all the work that we as text critical nerds do to try to kind of work our way back, we reach a point where it's like, okay, we don't have any more manuscripts to get us back to 50, right? We're at 200.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's basically a question of, okay, what's the most likely presupposition that in that 150-year period, it was a faithfully, divinely guided process of transmission that then continues after that?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it like the crazy wild, wild west? And so that's where New Testament scholars very much divide, where I'm in the camp of, I do think we have good reasons to make that inductive step backwards, but others don't. They think, well, you just can't.
And you have a whole bunch of assumptions baked into how
That's where you're going to have confessional faith and so forth.
Now,
come to the table.
Maybe switching gears a little bit with the Septuagint, So, you know, this morning you talked a little bit about the deuterocanonical books, mm-hmm. the Apocrypha,
right.
Tobit, Judith, or Second Maccabees, all those things. That were those included in the Septuagint?
What's the Septuagint again?
No, oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, was the translator, the people who were working on the broad project of this, of translating the old,
that's a better way to say it.
The Old Testament Hebrew text. How did they view those books that Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholics, although their canon lists differ, accept as part of the Old Testament canon? How did those Jews who were translating the Septuagint view those books?
We don't know. Because they didn't tell us, at least by and large. And some were translations and some weren't, actually. So Wisdom of Solomon almost certainly was not a translation of anything in the Hebrew. It's clearly just original composition.
Just written in Greek.
There's no Hebrew version of Wisdom of Solomon.
Yeah.
Epistle of Jeremiah, probably the same. First Maccabees, you can make a case that there was a Hebrew source text. We don't have a copy of it. We do have some fragments of some of the others that show that there was an original Hebrew text that had been translated. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. And we know for certain that Sirach is a translation, right? Because they tell us that, you know, the grandson who's Ben Seir's grandson say, hey, my grandfather wrote this in Hebrew and I'm translating. It's really hard. So that out of the gate is actually pretty important, that it's not all the same kind of thing. And in fact, historically speaking, it's really, honestly, kind of a random coincidence that they even got treated as an entity. They're not really an entity, any more so than all the other Jewish stuff, like First Enoch, Second Enoch, Ascension of Isaiah, or Ascension of Martin of Isaiah, Testament of Moses.
There's a bunch of stuff, right?
And some of it's also Qumran writings.
Yeah.
The only reason why they got treated separately is the three major, well, really four, but the three major later Greek major codices, which we also use for the New Testament, that have both Old and New Testament in them, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinus, have a mixed bag of these writings in them. And so on the Greek Orthodox side, they never really tell you which manuscript they're going with, and they don't all agree. You saw that this morning. Yeah. So Sinaiticus has some, Vaticanus has some, Alexandrinus kind of has a maximal list, but also throws in some other random things.
Yeah.
So there is no like coherency there, nor that they don't have them all in the same place. They're stuck here and there. They don't all like treat them as an appendix or anything. They're just kind of all scattered. And so it's actually, I've never been able to personally find in any sort of Greek Orthodox documentation which manuscript they think has the right Apocrypha.
So you're saying which manuscript, which Greek?
Which Greek manuscript. Right, so if you read sort of Greek Orthodox documentation from the Patriarchate and their Bibles and so forth, they'll say, we believe that the Greek Old Testament, so they don't even bother with the Hebrew at all, not really. So it's not, even for the normal books, Genesis or whatever. Their version of Genesis is not the Masoretic, the Greek, at least if they're consistent.
Yeah.
But they never really tell you, like, which collection are we using, because they don't all agree. Like, the manuscripts that we have these Greek Bible in don't even agree amongst themselves. So it's actually this weird thing. It's like, well, which one are you using? Because they don't all agree. Anyway, so I don't really know what to do with that. When it comes to the Roman Catholic side of the coin, it's a very different historical background. As you know, so the early church fathers were grappling with the fact that, hey, there's these extra books running around. People are aware of them, and they're interesting and useful and so forth. And so what do we do with them, essentially, was their question. And Origen and Augustine and Jerome, they kind of had different answers to that. And so Jerome, ultimately, a brilliant scholar, who actually, in contrast to most of the others, well, Origen was brilliant as well. They all are. But, you know, Augustine didn't know Hebrew, as an example. But Jerome said, all right, you know, fundamentally, I'm persuaded, and he's right here, as I've already attested, that he's like, okay, the scriptures are fundamentally the Hebrew scriptures. Right? He's the one who had that insight. He's like, yeah, I know we're using Greek. Fair enough, because we have to. We don't have any other option. None of us know Hebrew except for me, which is why he spent some time in Jerusalem learning Hebrew. He's like, all right, Hebrew is the thing, right, that we want to get back to. And so he originally was just working with the Septuagint when he was doing some early translations to Latin. But eventually he had a sort of come to Jesus moment where he says, actually, we got to go back to the Hebrew. So I'm going to go and give you a Latin translation of Pentateuch, et cetera, from the Hebrew, and that became the Vulgate. And he had all these commentaries about how he did it and so forth. And he was very aware, like, okay, sometimes the Greek says this, sometimes the Hebrew says this, but the Hebrew's right. Okay, so fair enough. But he's like, you know what? There's all these other books running around, and we have our spirited debates about what to do with them. I'm going to go ahead and translate them. And he kind of puts them in an appendix, sort of. He's like, but, and he's very clear about this in all of his prologues, we don't treat these as the same. He says, look, they're interesting, they're helpful. They're not going to like make your eyes burn out if you read them. You'll be okay. But don't use these to establish doctrine. And so it was his choice to take some of these Apocrypha and translate them into Latin because they were in most of these Bibles. It's like, I'm going to do it, but like, don't use them the same way that you would use the other books. And unfortunately, especially when you get to the Reformation era, because essentially what the Protestants did is they said, all right, we're scrapping the Vulgate. They still often use the language, but they're saying, okay, we're going to go back to the original. So we're going to go back to the Hebrew and Greek, which is what Jerome would have wanted them to do anyways, because that was the kind of guy he was. So we're going to not use the Vulgate anymore. We're going to go back to the Hebrew and Greek, but Jerome's right. Like, there's these other books and they're interesting, but they're not to be used to establish doctrine. And so the early Reformation Bibles all had the Apocrypha in them, typically as some sort of appendix or like in between. And it wasn't until a bit later that they started to even just pull them out altogether. And the Roman Catholics looked at that and said, no, that's anathema. If you don't accept these deuterocanonical books, it's anathema. So they actually, ironically, kept the Vulgate, but rejected Jerome's instructions, which is, these books are helpful, but not dogmatic. And what they did is they said they are dogmatic, and they call it second canon, deuterocanon, which doesn't mean secondary. It's actually fully canonical. Right. It's just the second canon, which is completely against what Jerome had in mind from the very beginning.
Why didn't his opinion win out?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I think you know, this is actually pretty instructive. My guess is, I'm not like a Reformation scholar, but my sense is it's one of those things where the polemical environment of the day really led the decision, which is, I think, important for us all to realize that a lot of times our lines in the sand are more like, this is a line in the sand because we're fighting about this right now. I mean, think about anything you read on the internet. It's like, oh, this now became a line in the sand. Well, that's because we're mad about it.
Right.
Not because there's like a compelling, like, but the Bible tells us we have to die on this hill. And so I think they died on the hill because it was a point of dispute with the Protestants, and because some of the doctrines that the Protestants were pushing on, supererogatory merit, purgatory, penance, alms, and so forth, were largely derived from apocryphal writings, not from the accepted canon.
What about like
so they had to keep it, otherwise they had to admit a problem, right?
Well, what about after Jerome, though? Like before the Reformation, it seems like the Apocrypha was adopted. Is that fair to say? Or between Jerome and the Reformation?
Depends on how you define adopted. I mean, the church fathers quote from lots of different things. Clement of Alexandria and others, they quote from everything all the time, and you know, including apocryphal books and pseudepigraphal books and all kinds of things. So it probably depends on who you ask, but I think there is probably a little bit wonky, but you know, if you look at the history of the church before the big split, most probably were quoting from, making use of the Apocrypha. However, the proportions are skewed way in the direction of the traditional books.
So it seems like there was this.
It's marginal.
There was still dispute after Jerome.
I don't know. Not really, because even after Jerome, when you get to the early canon list, like Athanasius, 100 years after Jerome, it is the 39 books.
Oh, okay.
There's no real debate, not including the Apocrypha.
Okay.
Because again, they weren't really, that's the weird thing is Jerome's like, hey, here's some extra books. I just threw them in there. Right, but they're not scriptural. And everyone's like, sure, fair enough. So I can quote from them. It doesn't mean that they're canonical. And then when you get to the canon list, it's like, these are the books. Now, as we saw this morning, some of the canon lists did throw a few of them in there. Yeah. But most of the time, that was because of misunderstanding.
So it wasn't like Jerome's like, I'm not sure about these. And they're like, well, we really want you to be sure about these.
I know.
They're like, okay. And then later on, they, you know, I guess.
I see where you're going now. So the canon list that we have, which is not many, but the canon list that we have leading up to Athanasius being the kind of final big one in 367, the Festal Letter, they're kind of all over the board in terms of they all agree on the traditional Old Testament books.
Yeah.
And there's like 12 of them that matter. And you can look them up in the book by John Mead and Ed Gallagher, where they document all this kind of stuff. And so they sort of go through all these lists from various people. climaxing with Athanasius. After Athanasius, it's kind of, there's no real debate anymore. But they all accept the 39, or however you want to number them, books that we have. And then some of them include some extra books. None of them have all of them. And it's a mixed bag. You know, it's like randomly someone will throw Tobit on the list.
Yeah.
And they're like, why? And then Eusebius is like, he's the one who's most clear. He's saying, here's the books we all agree on. Here's the books we debate. And here's why or why not they should be like voted off the island, if you will. So he's very clear in sort of saying, here's kind of where the debate lies. And these right. are the disputed ones. And these are the undisputed ones and so on. So they're all very kind of, no one's hiding anything. They're all, yes, they are debating it. But by and large, the weight of agreement is on Jerome's side. He ultimately won the argument. But there's always the sort of like, yeah, but let's throw Susanna and Bell and the Dragon in there or whatever. It's like, okay, well,
when did he win the argument? Because I hear from like Roman Catholic apologists will say that then you just have this sort of like, okay, people are debating about the Apocrypha, whether it should be in or out or which one should be in. Don't you need a point where we go, these are the ones that are in? These like, why did, like, when did Jerome win? It seems like in my mind,
He's in the 200s.
Yeah, he had this idea and then like nobody listened to him until the Reformation or something.
Well, I mean, the idea was the old idea, right? Is that, I mean, this is what we're going over this morning, is that all the evidence suggests, long before you get to Jerome, that there was a solidified threefold canon. You see that in Ben Sira, you see that in Dead Sea Scrolls, 4Q, MMT, you see that in Luke 24, Josephus.
Oh, I see. So he's just going, look, if we look at the Jews, they understand what mm-hmm. the canon is.
Yeah.
Why aren't we
Yeah, so he's like, believing it's them. Very clear. Okay, yeah. the Hebrew canon of the Jews is the canon.
Yeah.
Augustine and Origen was basically like, yeah, but you know, but also like people use the Greek too, so maybe we should too. He was kind of waffling. And Augustine actually changed his mind over the course of time because of Jerome. But Augustine was originally like, the church uses all these Greek books, so we can too. And then
he changed his mind.
Augustine was like, and the Hebrew doesn't matter. And Jerome's like, actually, based on Matthew quoting the Hosea thing, some other passages. He's like, no. Sometimes the apostles go back to the Hebrew too, by the way. And Augustine's like, oh yeah, interesting. All right, fair enough. So some of his later letters, he's like, yeah, okay, the Hebrew is important too. And yeah, we should probably pay attention to that. He never quite crosses the Rubicon, but that I'm aware of. But after them, it's kind of like, it's basically settled that the Hebrew canon is the canon. And then the question is, all right, what do we do with like the Epistle of Jeremiah? Is that part of Jeremiah or not? You know, that's kind of where some of the debates were.
It's not true that after Jerome,
you go from some debate among some people to it's dying off, and no one's saying like, all right, you get to pick. It's just like, what are we using? What's happening? It's just the same thing is true for the New Testament.
But
there's no magisterium who's going to lay down the law. They're not looking at anyone to tell us. They're just saying, all right, well, okay, this part of the empire does this, and we think this, and kind of where are we on this? And that's what Eusebius is trying to say. Kind of here's where the state of the question is, but it's really close to being kind of fully sussed out in Jerome's direction.
Okay, so
Hebrew books are the books. Everything else is interesting and useful, but not dogmatic.
And so even if, like at the time of the Reformation, you know, or right before it, would most of the Pew Bibles have had the Apocrypha? Because if that's the case, it seems like Jerome's opinion didn't win.
Well, what would the Pew Bible have been? For Europe, at least.
It would have been the Vulgate.
So what does the Vulgate have in it?
His caveat.
Well, it has the Apocrypha, but it may or may not have had his caveat, right?
Interesting, okay.
Well, you go to Palestine, right? And because there is... that's the thing. You got part of the empire has converted to Latin, and their Bible is the Vulgate.
Okay.
And the Vulgate has the Apocrypha.
Yeah.
That Jerome said, yeah, this is interesting, but don't use this to establish canonical doctrine. And that's what they ignored. The Greek East Byzantium is using what? The Greek Old Testament that had some of the Apocrypha.
Yeah.
And then the Palestinian community is using what?
The Hebrew.
The Hebrew text that ultimately becomes the Masoretic text from the sort of Babylonian period of crystallization. So you have, that's kind of where in between, that's kind of what you have.
Right.
And so then the Protestants come along and say, okay, we're going to follow Jerome's lead, go back to the Hebrew. And some of the early confessions, I mean,
it's almost like Jerome, the guy who's like, don't make this part of the canon. His work becomes the reason why it became viewed as part of the canon.
At least for the Roman Catholics.
At least for the Greek Orthodox. For those who are using his translation. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Wow, that is really.
And his insight is ultimately what the early reformers adopted.
Yeah,
like if you know, Westminster Confession is the most negative towards the Apocrypha, but you look at the Belgic Confession and some of the others, mm-hmm. 39 articles, they're less kind of strident earlier on in the 1500s. So you get to the Westminster's 100 years have passed, and they're more strident and like Apocrypha bad. Early on, it was more like Apocrypha, not canonical, but useful for edification, which is exactly Jerome's language. But they're just like, right. But we're going to go back to the Greek and Hebrew. And then I think because you have that decision on the Protestant side, that you have an equal and opposite Roman Catholic response, which is, all right, if you're going to do that, then we're going to dial it to the 11 on the Vulgate. And we're going to dial it to the 11 on the Apocrypha too,
right.
Which,
that's what, okay, so
which no one had been doing. That's the thing. Right, it's like no one had been taking the Apocrypha as equal.
Yeah.
That I'm aware, other than the Greek Orthodox, but for very different reasons.
Yeah.
But within the Roman West, I don't think that's how they were taking those books. And then the line gets drawn in the sand.
Right.
After that, in the 1500s, that's when.
Well, what was helpful about your presentation, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes so you guys can watch it, is that you kind of start talking about the content of some of the deuterocanonical books, the Apocrypha, and you talk about like a bird poop.
I mean, some of them are fun. Yeah. I mean,
bird poops on a guy or something like
Tobit
that.
Tobit is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but even some more serious ones where you talked about, Ben Sira, where, he's basically saying like, he defines the Law and the Prophets. He basically, that within the apocryphal text, they recognize an already existent canon that their writing is not a part of.
Right.
Like First Maccabees.
And Second Maccabees does that, yeah.
So it's like, I'm sure that's probably what tipped off Jerome.
I don't know in terms of, I'd have to look that up.
How did people, I mean, it seems very clear that like, why would they want to include it with that much internal evidence?
I mean, that for me, if I had to sort of pick a place to go in this conversation, I think the Ben Sira one is probably the most interesting.
Yeah.
Because it was definitely the most debated among the rabbis. Mm-hmm. He was
on its canonical status.
And well, in terms of, you know, God picks canon, not us. But in terms of, so the way the rabbis discuss it in the early centuries before you get to the full listing in the Talmud, which ends up being the same listing that we adopt in the Babylonian Talmud, the way they describe the books is, which books, quote unquote, defile the hands. And what that means is they're holy books that we must treat with respect. And if we're unclean, anyway, it's kind of a strange, puzzling way they describe it. And so no one doubted Torah, no one doubted prophets. A couple of what ultimately become part of the writings like Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes. Yeah, there was some debate on those for fairly obvious reasons. We still kind of grapple with like, what's going on with Song of Solomon? And the only apocryphal book that they really had any debate over was Ben Sira. And that's because A, it was demonstrably from Hebrew because he was a Hebrew rabbi and call it 200 BC. And he was world famous. One of the best they had pre like Gamaliel and Hillel.
So Hebrew origin was really important.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he wrote in Hebrew and he was a world famous rabbi. And so he writes these things and we have Hebrew copies and we also have the Greek. And then his grandson translates and the grandson says, we have many things in the Law of Moses, the prophets, and the writings that followed. So he gives it's the earliest threefold canon that we see and call it 150-ish BC ballpark. And then he says, and my grandfather saw fit to write something for edification. And so the grandson who is like, I want to translate this into Greek so people can read it. And it's really hard because Greek is hard. It's kind of funny what he says. He says, it's really hard to go from Hebrew to Greek. I'm like, yeah, well, join my world. I think it's remarkable that the person who's responsible for what becomes the deuterocanonical version of Ben Sira's work says that there is a threefold canon and this isn't part of it.
But like, I mean, how does that not just end the debate?
I don't know. In my opinion, it should.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think there's a rejoinder to that.
Yeah.
Unless you're simply saying, well, you know, the Pope said so and overrode him. I'm like, well, that makes, like, if the grandson of Ben Sira says that my father thought that what he is doing is just helpful things.
Right.
Wise advice for your kids. And it's not the same thing as the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. For me, that's like, well, authorial intent is kind of a big deal here, and he does not see himself writing canonical covenant documentation. Same thing, by the way, is true in 2 Maccabees, which is part of the Apocrypha, but actually specifies we have the law, the prophets, and the oracles of David, and newsflash, 2 Maccabees ain't it, right? Wow. So both of those two, I'm like, I don't know how you respond to that.
But if there is a, if they have that awareness, why did the Septuagint authors not just say these are, well, I guess it's, that's like, why was there a debate for including the Apocrypha in the different Septuagint editions?
I don't know if they were debating it. Like, so if you're,
whoever, they had an understanding of these.
Whoever are the, is compiling Codex Vaticanus, and they're like, all right, we got the normal books, got the New Testament.
Yeah.
And here's some other stuff we're going to throw in. Like, whoever is compiling that codex, and it's not just one person, for whatever reason said, hey, let's throw in random places some of these other things. It's possible that that person thought that those books were canonical, but who's, like, that doesn't mean anything.
But the Jews who were translating.
And these are Christians, by the way, who are compiling these codices.
Right. At that point, yeah. But for this, for the Septuagint, this is before Jesus' day when they're trying to...
No, I mean, Codex Vaticanus is much later, right?
Right.
350 AD, so...
Right, but the... weren't you saying, though, like the New Testament's quoting from a Greek translation?
Sometimes, yeah.
Right, and that Greek translation, the people were translating that, that's the, isn't... Is that the... Am I completely missing this? Is the Septuagint a pre-Gospels document?
It depends on how you define Septuagint. The effort to translate the Hebrew text into Greek starts well before the New Testament. Starts in 300, 250
BC. But they don't have like a completed one necessarily.
There are some that it's unclear when they were translated. Yeah. Like, it's pretty clear that you got the Torah, the earliest, probably followed by the Psalms or Isaiah, then probably, you know, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 prophets, and it goes from there. Job probably later, Ecclesiastes probably later, Proverbs probably later, but we don't know how late. Because we don't have, in general, we don't have a lot of early manuscripts. We do have some, but mostly for the Pentateuch. On the whole, the translational activities very much predate the New Testament, which is why they were able to at least use it in many situations.
But you don't know.
But if that's a different, but that's completely different from the Apocrypha issue, right?
Right, because you don't know if they included the Apocrypha.
We have no idea. Right? We know that the Apocrypha were written in that time frame. There's lots of stuff written in that time frame.
I see. But whether they
all that really matters is that fast forward to 400 AD.
Yeah.
Now you have these three big codices that throw a mixed bag of these books in there, and you don't have any idea why.
Right. Okay.
They just happened to be circulating in Greek.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, there was a Greek version of First Enoch by then. There was, you know, lots of the pseudepigrapha are Greek, and so I mean that's why it's like it's truly arbitrary why some of them made it into these books and others didn't. Like, I don't know why we don't have.
I think that's what I was missing.
The Testament, like, why aren't the Greek testaments of the 12 patriarchs in Codex Sinaiticus? I don't know. They run out of paper? I have no idea.
Yeah.
It's very arbitrary sort of which ones got thrown in as sort of extra material. But the fact that it was very inconsistent, for me at least, is one data point that there was no uniform, what is often called the Alexandrian Egypt canon is kind of a myth.
Okay.
One thing to realize is that, you know, given that our job is not to create canon, but to recognize canon, that does mean that there is room for people to not have full agreement, but that doesn't mean anything at the end of the day, because who picks canon?
God does.
Not us. Right, yeah. I mean, that's probably the biggest dividing line between us and Roman Catholics is we would say God is the one who picked canon by virtue of inspiration in the original autographs. And our goal is to try to recognize and reconstruct that. Whereas probably a Roman Catholic would say, no, the church picks canon. And I would argue that was never our job, right? No one ever said you get to pick the books that you want to use.
Well, they probably say that they can infallibly recognize it.
Okay, fair enough. And I would say, I believe the church has, through the Spirit, recognized the canon, and it's the Hebrew canon that we've all agreed on until roughly 1500s,
right?
By and large. So, I mean, it's just... to me, that's where the evidence leads. But part of it is you have to go back earlier. That's what I was trying to do this morning.
Yeah.
Is if you start with canon lists in the 400s, you're starting at the wrong time period. that's an important data point, but you go way back. You can go way further back and look at other evidence that fleshes out the picture.
I think that was the missing link for me, where I was assuming that the Septuagint in its, I guess, those three codexes in its kind of final form was, that's what they would have been looking at in Jesus' day or in the writing of the Gospels.
And just there wasn't even technology to do that back then, right?
Right.
It was only when you get to the third and fourth century that you even have the ability to make books that could hold all that. So that alone would limit the ability to say, okay, anything between these two covers is the canon, right? You know, codex, the contents of a codex doesn't necessarily mean that's what you think your canon is. Because we do the same thing with our Bibles today. We've got a bunch of, like, one of my old Bibles has all the Reformation confessions in it.
Yeah.
And even though I revere them, they're not canonical, right? They're subject to correction and so forth. But they're in my Bible.
Yeah.
I take them to church. Just because it's between those two covers doesn't really say anything about the canon. It might help you clarify what is canonical. And if something's not in there, then that would be a bit of a problem.
Right.
But that's not what we find. You know, it's not like there's all these codices running around that are missing Jeremiah, right?
Right.
But they might have extra stuff, and we don't know why they have extra stuff. They just do. And it could just be because they thought it was helpful.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is a fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, it is complicated, but I mean, one thing I've been thinking about too is that just because it's complicated doesn't mean we can't trust what we have now.
Right.
But we still can look at evidence. And I mean, you know, if the process is though so fraught with complexity, like, I mean, I don't know, 500 years from now, could we find out that, well, actually maybe Tobit should have been in there, or, you know what I mean?
Like,
when did the process stop?
I mean, on the Old Testament side, I'm pretty well persuaded that by the time of Jesus, you have a solidified threefold
canon. That was pretty powerful evidence that you showed that they had that understanding.
I mean, it's true that you don't have anyone sort of listing all exactly which books fall into the law, the prophets, and the writings. But I mean, deductively, what falls in the law? Obviously, it's,
and for the New Testament,
Genesis to Deuteronomy.
There's no disagreement among
exactly
the big traditions on the New Testament. So,
and so, for me, even though I don't have, Jesus doesn't list all the books that should be included in the quote unquote writings of third division. The fact that they all can talk about the divisions in similar language across Philo, Josephus, Jesus, Qumran, Ben Sira, and so on, to me suggests that there was some community agreement that these are the books.
Yeah.
Did they have, like, what do we do with Ecclesiastes? All right, fair enough. I get that. I can understand. It's just like the early church did have some dispute about Revelation. Obviously they did, because they're like, what do we do with this? I get that. And they eventually like, okay, it's just from God. And I'm sorry if we were arguing about it or whatever. But so for me, I think the process was actually essentially done in the time of Jesus. That which is why he never felt compelled to address it, or Paul didn't either. It's like, these are the books. And you could point to, like, okay, you go to the synagogue. I mean, here's the thing. The reality is you would go to a synagogue and they have a concrete set of books in their Torah cabinet.
Yeah.
Like when Jesus goes back to Nazareth and he goes to the synagogue, Nazareth's a podunk town, but he's like, they handed him the scroll of Isaiah. So even in Nazareth, they had probably a Hebrew scroll of Isaiah that would have been part of the prophet collection. And so it seems like at that point, there was a coherent collection of scrolls that you could point to and say, that's God's word. Like, that's what we take to be from God. And it's shaped in a threefold canon. They quote from them a lot. They refer to them by name, almost all of them. We talked about that this morning. And you just don't see that for the other books. They're aware of the other books, but you don't see that kind of privileging of the status. And so is it possible in Jesus' day that there was still some latent debate about, probably Esther and Ecclesiastes would be the two they would debate? Esther, because God's not explicitly mentioned. Ecclesiastes, frankly, just because it's kind of weird. Maybe. Yeah.
But they're not worrying about
and,
first
and the New
second.
Testament doesn't quote from those two books, so that's
part of the challenge.
But for me, that's kind of a rounding error in the broader conversation of, there's a coherent collection of books and this is what it is. And so what we're trying to do is kind of go back and say, okay, let's give that its full weight and not let later debate kind of cloud that fundamental reality. So for me, I'm not waiting for Jerome. I'm not waiting for Council of Nicaea. I'm not waiting for Athanasius. I think the evidence points in that direction, that it was pretty well set, with maybe some room for discussion. But in general, everyone's like, yeah, these are the books.
Well, I'm glad that you're She wrote a book on the Septuagint. I'm glad you're doing this kind of research. It's really helpful. In my mind, I'm like, well, if Greg Lanier's not worried about it, I'm not going to be worried about it. You know?
I find it all just very fascinating.
It is fascinating.
And interesting. Yeah, and not everyone does. And part of it is, you know, you have to have an appetite to say, I don't know yet.
Yeah.
Right. And an appetite to like, oh, I got a lot to learn. An appetite to say, you know, one of the hardest, and you probably gathered this in seminary, one of the hardest things about maturing as a Christian is realizing that history is complicated.
Hmm.
And I don't think I was ready to admit that either as a cage stage Calvinist.
You don't admit much.
That's true. Because like the reformers got everything right. It's like, actually they didn't get everything right. Although I still am a reformed person. And so same thing about history. It's like, okay, the more I dig into it, the more I realize, you know, history is messy, but you know what else would I expect?
Yeah.
You read the Old Testament like, yeah, man, we are messed up. I mean, if they lost the whole Bible,
I was
for
just
a long
thinking
time,
about that. I know.
Until
I know.
Josiah helped, you know, they found it in the wall or whatever. Like, all right, this is a pretty messy process, but you know, God has been faithful, I think. And the fact that it actually is as accurately, I mean, even if you ask them, like, so historical critical scholars want to maximize all the kind of loose ends and weirdness because they got to write books and so forth. And we have a tendency to minimize those things. So it cuts both ways. But everyone admits, like, you know what, but we're still talking about like a pretty small percentage.
Yeah.
And in reality, yeah, so there's some weirdness in 1 Samuel and the David and Goliath story. Is it long or is it short? And there are some things that we really need to grapple with. Which version of Jeremiah is most accurate, the long one or the short one? So there are some real questions, but by and large, you're like, this is kind of impressive that there's this much stability. Yes, in the periphery, and these are things we shouldn't minimize, we shouldn't put our head in the sand, we also shouldn't maximize and say that, oh, we don't know anything. I actually know 90%, the same thing is true on the New Testament side, is very stable, and we can bank on that. And then we just do the hard work for the other stuff. Same thing on the New Testament side. It's like, yeah, let's have our debate about the endings of Mark or the adulterous woman, but let's not let that cloud the fact that we have a very reliable historical, a New Testament that we can reconstruct with the evidence that we have, a very high degree of confidence, where we can say, okay, this is the word of God, right? Or this is scripture. This is what Paul wrote.
Right.
Yeah, maybe I don't know exactly for this verse if it's this word or that word, but that's the main point is like, no, we can pretty well say that this is what Paul wrote.
And we're not hiding anything.
Right.
You know, there's not this sort of like conspiracy.
At least we're not supposed to be hiding anything.
We're not supposed to, right, yeah.
I mean, the temptation is to downplay, but I don't think we should. I mean, that's what
with
lay people. I know some of these topics and probably the listeners have already turned the channel to Netflix, but we don't have a lot of patience for the hard work that this requires, which is sad. Maybe back in the olden days they did because they didn't have Netflix, but I guess what I'm trying to say is the long way home ultimately, like to do the hard work, for me at least, has gotten me to a better place.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I don't get the panic, but I was like, oh yeah, we're fine. We'll
be okay. Yeah, yeah.
But it requires, like, it seems boring, it seems scholarly, but I do think if you sort of trust, okay, that this is actually important to engage with, there are answers. Or at least here's the data and we're not 100% sure yet and we can be okay saying that. To me, that's actually been a huge net positive as opposed to like, either this is boring, I don't care, or like, you know, I'm not going to worry about the data.
Well, it reminds me just general apologetics. Sometimes when you dig deeper into atheist arguments or Christian arguments, you realize it's not as simple. But then when you dig in, it's not as simple for the opposing side either.
Yeah.
It's not as simple to just be skeptical about everything either. And I think so. The complexity, I think, can cut both ways. Thanks for spending your time, you know, having a discussion. I know you've been talking all day, but this was great. This was fantastic. Appreciate all your work on this. And again, we're going to put some links to your books in our show notes. And Greg, thanks for joining
us. Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you guys for listening in. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Leave a nice review for us. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find some of our podcast content there as well. And if you want to partner with us for $2 a month, just $2 on Patreon, we'll have that link in our bio as well. So thank you guys for listening. We'll catch you guys next week.